Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear oral arguments from petitioner in Dubai Petroleum versus Cosby.
May it please the court, Ms. Tracy Willis to present arguments to the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, the sole issue before this court is the interpretation of a Texas statute, specifically whether India has equal treaty rights with the United States on behalf of its citizens. There are two reasons why the dismissal for lack of subject matter jurisdiction was appropriate in this case. These are independent grounds. The first is that none of the treaties between the United States and India guarantee a right of access to Indian citizens to the courts of the United States, or for that matter, of Texas. Secondly,
in order for that to matter, then, don't you have to define equal treaty rights in the statute as meaning a right of access?
Yes, Your Honor, that is part of what I think, why I think this court could elaborate on its footnote that it cited in Dow Chemical versus Alfaro.
What authority and where do we look besides Alfaro to the definition of equal treaty rights?
I think that we can look to the history of the statute and when that statute was actually enacted. In this case, it was enacted back in 1913. The types of treaties that were that the United States was engaging in at that time were treaties such as the Friendship, Commerce, and Navigation Treaty, such as the treaty that was involved with Costa Rica. In particular, there were no treaties such as the UN Charter or the International Covenant at that time, which were multilateral treaties, which I think are totally different animals from what was intended by the legislature to be covered by this issue.
Were there specific treaties at that point in time that had access to American court provisions?
Yes, there were, Your Honor.
And were there other kinds of treaties that did not?
Yes, there were, Your Honor.
So how do we know that at that point in time, equal treaty rights specifically means a treaty that gives access to courts?
I think we can know that because If it didn't mean access, if it just meant general treaty rights, we would not have had to include this provision to our statute. We could have just left it as it was and not included the term that requires us to. What I think the legislature was trying to do there is they were trying to put some kind of a limit on what kinds of foreign cases that Texas courts had to entertain. They said if you were a foreign citizen, you could bring that right of action. At first, the statute said only if where you're coming from they recognize that cause of action. Otherwise, Texas courts didn't have to entertain jurisdiction. When the legislature did away with that provision, basically changing it so that if you could sue if you had a statute under the law of this state as well, so it basically did away with that exception. The only issue which hadn't been addressed by the court, because it always had been disposed of upon that first issue, was whether the, in the case of a foreign citizen only, whether your country had equal treaty rights. I think what the legislature was trying to do was they acknowledged that they could limit jurisdiction, but only as far as they could limit their jurisdiction, but only as far as there wasn't a treaty, some supreme law of foreign nations out there that tells us we have to exercise jurisdiction at least to get them in the door and provide equal access. I think the other reason why we can look at access as a key language is because, as you said, there were some, or as I was explaining to you, there were some statute or treaties that provided access and others that don't. Even today, when our Congress is entering into treaties, some provide access and others specifically don't. In fact, as our amicus brief pointed out, supplied to us by Avia Teca, Nicaragua is one of those countries where we had an FPN treaty. It specifically provided for equal access. It was done away with by executive order in 1985 when there were various diplomatic relations that were going awry over there. And when the United States entered into a new agreement with them, it was a friendship and cooperation agreement which did not explicitly provide for equal access. This issue of equal access has also been reviewed by Murray versus British Broadcasting in the Second Circuit. And in that case, they discussed they discussed various treaties that had equal access clauses in them and various others which did not. And they used that as the key determination for whether the plaintiff would be accorded the same deference under the federal form non-convenience statute.
Are any of the modern multilateral treaties have a provision on equal access to courts?
I have not seen any equal access provisions in any of the multilateral agreements, Your Honor, but I admit I have not looked at all of them that do not involve India, that India is not a signatory. So there may be one out there, but I very much doubt it.
What are the BIT treaties?
They're bilateral investment treaties, Your Honor, and they're similar to an FDN-type treaty, wherein they're a bilateral treaty like most FDNs are, whereas they're a very carefully negotiated treaty which contain explicit language on what rights are determined by that treaty, and there's never been a court that has said that an FDN treaty is non-self-executing. They assume that it is because it is such a carefully negotiated agreement, and it's between two parties, and everybody knows who's affected by it and how far the treaty goes.
Do any of the BITs have access to court provisions that you know about?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe some of them do. The ones that I've looked at, I've looked at several, and there are several with other nations that contain some kind of access language. I don't know if they would particularly qualify under our treaty statute because some of those are very specifically related to like personal property or some specific right that the bilateral investment treaty is.
Isn't the essence of your argument that Texas courts will allow foreign nationals to bring a suit in our court if they're from a country that was in existence at the turn of the century, at the time that we were drafting a certain type of treaty? But if these people are unfortunate enough to be from a newly emerging country, they're out of luck.
No, Your Honor, that's not my argument. In fact, there have been several treaties that guarantee access that have been entered into in 1993. Congress still uses equal access as a term that they negotiate with. And I think for this court to determine that a treaty that does not explicitly provide for equal access, that somehow it can be implied from that language, I think would be an invasion of the congressional prerogative whether to negotiate that as part of the treaty. For instance, our amicus pointed out that Nicaragua and some others, Iraq and Libya, diplomatic ties have been severed. And to say that this general multilateral treaty, which is merely aspirational and promises future action, future congressional implementation to make it the laws of the various nation states that are parties to it, would say that Nicaragua, for example, has equal access when the executive order in 1985 specifically revoked it and it's not been explicitly granted. There are several nations to the ICCPR, the International Covenant, that we don't have that type of relationship with. We don't have any other treaties that provide equal access, and to write in this additional explicit term, which Congress avoided doing, especially in a multilateral agreement, I think is overstepping what the judiciary is here to interpret.
You mentioned treaties executed in 1993 that have equal access terms. What can you identify those for us?
There was one that we cited in our brief, and that was the Latvia Treaty. Again, it was one of these newly formed countries that we decided to extend various equal access rights and other rights to. And one that we cited in the amicus brief was Uzbekistan. That one specifically provides for equal access as well, and the particular language that provides that equal access are cited in the brief.
In those equal access treaties, could Texas exercise form nonconvenience and throw the case out?
Yes, Your Honor. I think depending on whether once they get in the court under this jurisdictional statute, then we can apply our various analysis that's provided for.
So an equal access treaty executed by the U.S. government can create jurisdiction in Texas state courts.
in Texas state courts, it I think would, I don't think that if it were a valid treaty and it provided specifically for equal access, I think that Texas would have to exercise at least subject matter jurisdiction. Whether it could, on its discretion, dismiss the form of convenience for some other reason is another issue.
You made a reference earlier in your argument to the 1913 law and an attempt to keep Texas courts from being flooded. Do you know what the evil was that the legislature was trying to remedy at that time? Were they indeed, is there any evidence they were trying to limit foreign national lawsuits in Texas by passing this act?
Well, all that we can tell from that that statute are the cases that were determined after it. There is no case recordings or anything like that in the legislative history.
Was there anything in?
But there were cases such as Mexican nationals trying to bring suit, or even at that point, Texas citizens trying to bring suit for an accident that happened in a foreign state such as Mexico. And those cases would find that since there wasn't a cause of action available in Mexico, Texas courts did not have to exercise jurisdiction of the case.
Now, a lot of these treaties could have simply been some sort of recognition that if our citizens were allowed access to their courts, their citizens would be allowed access to our courts, and you wouldn't use that language. You'd just simply say if they afford our citizens their citizenship rights, we'll afford their citizens our citizenship rights. And that would, of course, encompass the right to defend yourself in court or perhaps even to bring a claim in court.
Yes,
so
sir.
Why does it have to be an explicit access to courts to produce this result?
Well, one of the reasons, Your Honor, is because the legislature did not say simply that we would have equal rights in both courts. And I think it could be under some interpretations meant to be also reciprocal rights in the other court. But if they said equal treaty rights, that's why it has to occur in a treaty. And so we have to ask ourselves, well, what has to occur in a treaty? We have treaties with various nations. Is just having a treaty that allows fishing in India and the United States, is that enough to allow access to our ports? I don't think so. I think you have to have something that overcomes our jurisdictional bar in Texas, which was that you have to have equal treaty rights on behalf of citizens of India that guarantees them access to our ports. That's the only thing that would overcome our ability in Texas to
equal treaty rights for you means that India, we have, our treaty has to guarantee Indian nationals access to our courts.
Yes, Your Honor.
So equal treaty somehow doesn't mean that we have the same, India affords the same rights that we would afford here, or we afford the same rights India does. It means specifically we have been directed by our own government to open our courts.
Yes, Your Honor, that's my argument. I think that there are ways to interpret this to say it also has to be reciprocal, but the treaties that provide for equal access to courts, I can't imagine one that wouldn't provide it reciprocally.
What do you dispute? I think that representation was made in the brief that India does allow American citizens access to their courts.
There were both sides talked to people who were knowledgeable about India law. And during that discussion, there was some discussion that, in fact, the people who were suing in this case could bring an action in India, and possibly even someone outside of India could bring an action in India. But it wasn't pursuant to a treaty. It was just pursuant to their own domestic laws, which could change tomorrow because there's no treaty guarantee.
But at the present time, India does allow American citizens to sue in their courts.
I believe that's true, Your Honor.
And it's not pursuant to any particular treaty?
Correct. There's no treaty that's forcing India to do that. And so, for all we know, they could change tomorrow and write some jurisdictional statute like we have that says unless there are equal access rights or equal treaty rights with the United States, we don't have to exercise jurisdiction over this case.
One thing that you mentioned that I wanted to ask you about, you said that on behalf of its citizens, that language or that phrase in the statute modifies the foreign country as opposed to the United States. Am I correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it does. It doesn't make sense to me that the legislature would say that India has to have guarantees on behalf of United States citizens, because foreign countries do not enter into treaties on behalf of other countries' citizens. Only the United States can on behalf of its citizens, and I think I've heard it being interpreted that way, and I really don't think it makes much difference. Your Honor, if I see that I'm out of time, I also have a self-execution issue. If you want me to reserve that for rebuttal, I would do so.
Any questions at this time? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Jordan Powell will present argument for the respondent.
There are two issues I want to hit first, and the second one pertains to the interpretation of the Texas statute, and that happens to be the first of three issues that we raised for affirmance of the decision below. And that's all we have to do today is affirm the decision below. The first argument of petitioners has come up again as the floodgates argument, and it is really an unreal fantasy. Let me explain why. This statute is 85 years old. It's been reenacted several times, and there are very few cases that have occurred throughout the history of the state of Texas since the statute was enacted. There has been no flood of litigation in courts in Texas. There are very few cases that are still pending after the 1993 change of the statute. And this is only the second case that has come up before this court. Importantly also, in 1993, at the suggestion of three of the justices who appear before me, the Texas legislature closed the door and slammed it shut on non-inquiry in the form non-convenience. It happens that this lawsuit was filed 2 weeks before that statute took effect. For the future, there will be no flood of litigation. There hasn't been for 85 years. For the future, there will be no flood because form non-convenience is the gatekeeper, as we explain in respondent's brief, pages 24 to 25. In terms of the so-called Alfaro four-part test, I'd like you to shift your attention to tab one of respondent's bench brief that was before you today. In tab one, we have outlined for you, we provided actually an extract from the Texas statute, and Justice Ray's footnote, Justice Ray's dictum in note two in the Alfaro case. If you look at the express language chosen by the legislature, not only in 1913, but through constant reenactment, and also in 1993, even though Justice Hightower suggested that the legislature amend the treaty to add more limiting words, really the legislature chose not to add any further limiting words with respect to the equal treaty rights phrase. It kept that phrase intact. It did accept the Gonzales Chief Justice Hecht approach and adopted form non convenience as the break. However, it kept the equal treaty rights phrase intact. Now, normally a court does not have the power to add limiting words that the legislature expressly has not chosen, or at least has not chosen to add to the statute. And as I look at the statute, Your Honor, the test is clear. All that we have is that India has, not even an India national, but we can live with that alternatively, that India have equal treaty rights with the United States on behalf of its nationals.
What does that mean?
India does have such rights.
What does that mean?
Modern-age treaties. That India, that the treaty doesn't have to be self-executing, for example. That India has these rights itself. That they not do not have to be the rights of Indian nationals. But in any event, we can explore the question alternatively.
Well, what is
very broad, where do we, it's a very broad statement. Yes.
Where do we look at, you know, Justice Hankinson asked a question, where do we look to for a definition of equal treaty rights?
Yes. Well, of course, we look to the treaty law of the United States and the Supremacy Clause. We're bound to do that. All treaties are supreme law of the land under Article 6, Clause 2. And we look at the approach to interpretation of treaties that have been adopted by the Supreme Court because, of course, that raises a federal question for review.
You cite a Second Circuit case about liberal interpretation, whether you have a restrictive interpretation or a more broad interpretation. We are to favor the broad interpretation.
The courts in the United States.
The court spoken on that issue?
Yes, the court, yes. If you will turn to tab two, Your Honor. interpretation of treaties, we have guidance from Article 31 of the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, which itself is authoritative and customary. You can see the restatement and the Pals Treatise on pages 286 to 287, for example. A treaty is to be interpreted not merely with respect to its terms, not a strict constructionist interpretation approach at all with respect to treaty law under international law. But you're supposed to look at the context of the treaty, and you can see in Article 31.1, and in light of the object and purpose of the treaty. And that allows for supplementation of content by reference to object and purpose. If you look a little further down in Article 31.3, we see that also in addition to the text and the preamble, which obviously can evidence object and purpose as well as other articles, we look at subsequent practice in the application of the treaty. And in this circumstance, there's some very informing practice. There is an authoritative committee set up by the covenant, for example, which is the focus of the court opinion below, the primary focus of the court, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And the comments of that committee, comments numbers 13 and 15, that we have prepared for you in two places, in two tabs in this bench brief. And we've given you actually now the UN document itself with the full comments numbers 13 and 15. The comments supplement the meaning of Article 14 of the Covenant and Article 2 and Article 50, because this is subsequent practice set up through the treaty process. In fact, the committee has the authority to clarify the meaning of the treaty as states file report with this committee and as the committee responds and creates general comments that are not subject to, that are not state-specific, but that are subject-specific. If you look a little farther down, Article 31, Paragraph 3, in tab number 2, we also see the relevant rules of international law are utilized both at the international level under international law and in the United States Supreme Court, Your Honor, to answer your question, as supplemental interpretive devices to provide additional content. For example, in Wilson and Arbery, cited also in their brief, Wilson documented that for a major part of our history, over half of our treaties, FCN and commercial treaties, did not have equal treaty rights of access expressly in the instruments. Nevertheless, it's important to look at pages 21 to 24 and his conclusion at page 47 in the Wilson article, that nevertheless, we imply customary rights of access in any such treaty that the United States ratifies. This is a matter of supreme federal law.
You say any such treaty?
Any commercial treaty. Now, Wilson also did reference the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in his article, and he said it is an authoritative interpretive guide. He was writing very early in our history, too, in the 50s. He also referenced...
petitioner's example, if they have a treaty regards fishing rights, that would imply full access to courts.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. We would be looking at things like a counselor convention where the counselor has an express right of representation. As we document in our brief, there is a counselor convention in this circumstance. The counselor conventions were also addressed by Wilson as being relevant, and you find these implied rights of access to court because it makes sense that the counselor be able to effectively represent the nationals from his or her state as they deal with the United States.
In the petitioner's reply brief, they've got a footnote, too, and they list a number of authorities with parentheticals, but virtually all say that India does not have equal treaty rights with the United States. Could you address those authorities?
First, Your Honor, if you check those authorities, so-called, they're two student works and two works by professors. Secondly, we will accept the works by the two professors. In any event, none of these works thoroughly investigated the very treaty before the slip opinion that was referenced to in that one case. Secondly, none of the expositions were very thorough in any event in terms of inquiring into whether or not there are treaty rights that are equal treaty rights between India and the United States. Third, Professor Stein, for example, addressed merely express treaty rights. He did not have any inquiry really into implied treaty rights. And moreover, in this case, it's very informing that all of those articles were written before 1992 when the United States ratified the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. To the extent that those alleged authorities are different in our approach, we disagree with those terse statements, conclusory statements of the professors and the student
board. Is it your position that we have equal treaty rights with all signatories to the International Covenant?
Yes, Your Honor, and if you will consider also in tab 2 the U.S. case law, how we interpret the treaty. It's very important because the court opinion below quoted Asankala versus City of Seattle. We've laid that out for you again in tab 2 at the bottom of tab 2. And we've identified many Supreme Court cases that inform us that we must interpret treaties in a broad manner in favor of rights that may be claimed under the treaty. I'd like to also quote Owings versus Norwood's lessee. It's an 1809 case that supplements this approach by Chief Justice Marshall. And he stated, whenever a right grows out of or is protected by a treaty, it is sanctioned against all the laws and judicial decisions of the states. And whoever may have this right, it is to be protected. This is how we interpreted treaties even at the time of the Amiable Isabella. And the Amiable Isabella cited partly, quoted partly in the petitioner's brief, was really a case that only addressed the need to follow appropriate rules of interpretation. Tab 2, Your Honors, are the appropriate rules of interpretation.
Professor,
to answer your question,
can I ask you a question, please?
I would turn to tab 3, but I have a question from Justice Gonzalez. Yes.
I know you don't want to be here. You were on the Court of Appeals, and we granted writ, much to your chagrin. But since the legislature has changed the law based on our prior decision, is whatever we write here, except for the parties, be dead letter?
There are a few cases, Penny. They're so rare. Whatever you write here has to be with reference to the language chosen by the Texas legislature, but it's not quite dead letter. Is that an answer? I can answer the other justice's question, if we turn to tab 3 and we look at the covenant, and Your Honors, I disagree very much with the broad statement of the petitioners that as we look at Article 14, it does not relate to an express set of language that relates to, if not provide directly, a right to a hearing before our courts, and that it does not expressly provide this right, quote, to all persons, and, quote, to everyone, which includes alien persons. In fact, it's quite clear that Article 14, Paragraph 1 applies to all persons and everyone, and then in the determination of their rights and obligations in a suit at law, they shall be entitled to a hearing. That's clear enough. In any event, we can supplement that, as Wilson suggests, and the restatement and my treatise on international laws, law of the United States, please see Chapter 1 and Chapter 9. By customary international law, for example, the general customary right of access that Wilson identifies, first. Second, the customary right to freedom from denial of justice, which is always read into a treaty. Denial of justice is a customary precept that is directly binding on this court as it is binding on the United States. We have a quote in our tab to the Restatement of Foreign Relations Law, Section 115, where the restatement recognizes that customary international law is also binding on the Supremacy Clause.
Well, back to my other question. So any treaty will do?
No, I would say we have to look at the treaty in light of its object and purpose.
Well,
language is important, but we can suffer.
Treaty always imports no denial of justice.
That any treaty? No, Your Honor.
I misunderstood.
No, that, I would not say that. We have 8 treaties that provide equal access to courts in this case, and the lower opinion did rely heavily on the covenant, but also recognized that the other treaties supported their conclusion. They didn't rely only on the covenant. Secondly, they referred to the Boddy affidavit, Professor Boddy from the University of Texas. And Professor Boddy in his affidavit referred to several treaties as well. To answer your Honor's earlier question more specifically, also in tab 3, we have the authoritative general comments 13 and 15 prepared in an easy form for you. They were quoted in our brief. And we have the comments in another tab at the end of this brief set of documents that we've provided today.
I read the Court of Appeals opinion to say the other three treaties are not broad enough.
Well, if Your Honor will look at the page just following the exposition of the rights under the covenant, where they conclude that they are similar to, even using the Alfaro footnote, it's really just a Ray's footnote in Alfaro. Even if you use that test as the test, and we can live with that test alternatively, either the express language of the statute or the Alfaro footnote, similar treaty provisions, not exact treaty provisions, not express treaty provisions, not the same treaty provisions, not FCN treaties as such, but a number of other treaty provisions could comply. If you turn to the next page, Your Honor, you'll see.
I understood you say that the Court of Appeals said there were more than one treaty, and the three treaties they reject with these words, they are not broad enough to guarantee access generally to the courts of each country on the basis of equality.
Generally, Your Honor, and I see in the section of the opinion on the other three treaties, there might be a slight inconsistency in the opinion below, and I stress the word generally, but look at the language in the third paragraph.
How can that be read to say that those treaties do support equal?
Well, we read the opinion, of course, in its entirety. In the fourth paragraph in the section on the other three treaties, our main focus must first be on the first treaty discussed. As I turn the page, I see a paragraph after a quote starting, "In our opinion, this treaty does provide," and then a sentence that states, "the three other treaties discussed above are consistent with such an interpretation. Further, the affidavit of Professor Boddy supports their conclusion." So there's some possible ambiguity, Your Honor, in one section of the court's opinion, but if you put them together, the court is not throwing out necessarily all the other treaties. And in any event, we've provided in Appendix 2, I think Appendix 2 in our brief is very useful. Appendix 2 in Respondent's brief lists for you the eight treaties and why they actually comply even with the so-called fantasy test of the four-part Dow dictum, or Dow versus Alfaro dictum in footnote 2, which is only Justice Gray's test. The test, Your Honor, again, does not include express rights, even under the similar treaty provisions. That's the language in footnote 2. Similar treaty provisions. It does not require express treaty provisions. It does not require express access to courts. If we turn back to tab 2, we have express treaty provisions in the covenant, which was the primary focus in the court below. And for that reason alone, alternatively, Your Honor, you can support the decision below. We have an authoritative supplementation in tab 3 in the general comments, numbers 13 and 15 in this case. And we have a further supplementation in accordance with tab 2, the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, Article 31.3c, with customary international law. The prime example of a denial of justice is the denial to alien persons of access to courts. I remember a question, I think it was Justice Gonzalez, who asked, if not Chief Justice, whether or not foreign nonconvenience can also apply even if there is access to courts. And if the question wasn't to ask straight out that way, I think it's a useful question. And I recall the petitioner said, yes, we agree, foreign nonconvenience is consistent with principles, comity, as well as principles concerning conflict of laws, balancing of different interests, looking at this contextually in terms of legal policies at stake.
Is the amicus correct that your client had been a citizen of Iraq or Libya? You could make the same argument you're making here today on the basis of the international covenant.
Your Honor, that's a rabbit trail that's full of bugaboos that implicate foreign affairs and political questions. And if I could cite you a case in just a second, I will. It's a case involving a question of whether a federal court should look at such a question. And the Supreme Court of the United States ruled that they cannot. In any event, it's Charlton versus Kelly, Supreme Court case. And I will find this in 1 second.
But in the meantime, your answer is yes.
And the argument would be the same for... Yes, and there are three reasons.
Let me ask my question. The argument would be the same if the plaintiff in this case were a citizen of Iraq or Libya.
Yes. Libyan nationals have access to our courts under the customary precept of denial of justice. That's supreme law of the land, period. This court cannot interpret the Texas statute inconsistently with that customary law under the supremacy clause. Yes, Your Honor, to finish an answer to your question, it is the President of the United States who determines one of three options or to exercise none of these against Libya or Iraq. And to finish the point, it is the President of the United States who can suspend a treaty, who can terminate a treaty, or who can exercise the right of the United States under the covenant under Article 4 to engage in a derogation of the right of access to courts under Article 14. Even though Article 50 mandates that this treaty apply in all circumstances, and the Bush administration made no reservation to Article 50, this is a partly self-executing treaty. Your Honor, the President has chosen not...
Excuse me, your time is...
I'm sorry. Your Honor, the President has chosen not to.
Are there any other questions?
I have one question for you, Professor. I understand there was some criticism as to how the Supreme Court Journal summarized your case. Were there some factual errors in the way the Supreme Court Journal summarized the case?
Is this not the Supreme Court summarization?
No, the Supreme Court Journal summarization.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I haven't...
But the clerk informed us that you or your co-counsel were in disagreement with the summary. My question is very simple.
Yes.
Are there any factual errors in this summary?
There are legal errors in the summary, yes, Your Honor.
Legal error, but no factual error.
Yes, the statement in issue number 3, as I recall, is entirely false, as it is claimed. Right. If the treaty is not self-executing...
You've answered the question.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, I just want to make it clear. You do understand that our court had absolutely nothing to do with that summary, that it's prepared by the folks that do the journal, which were totally unrelated to the court.
Yes.
Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Ms. Willis, since the legislation has changed the law, why is this case important to the jurisprudence of Texas?
It's very important, Your Honor, and this court's analysis will not be dead letter. The first issue that every trial court has to address is whether it has subject matter jurisdiction. If it doesn't, then all rulings after that are void. The court has to have subject matter jurisdiction. That issue can be raised at any time. So it's very important that the courts do this part of it right before they go on to form non-jurisdiction
issues. Just raised a question on this regard. If earlier we talked about the access to courts under the treaty was really a direction of the United States government to Texas to open its courts.
Yes, sir.
In the face, if we interpret this equal treaties rights to be that specific and to mean exactly that, then on what basis would our courts be able to exercise forum non conveniens to shut the courts to inconvenient cases?
I think that once they get in the door and Texas has to exercise jurisdiction over them under the subject matter jurisdiction statute, then we go into an analysis whether they're treated fairly under our forum non conveniens law. I haven't done that analysis to find out which way it would come out in our case right now. I suppose they would have to be treated equally under that clause of whether our statute provides for due process, for equal protection, for that kind of thing, now that they're in our courts and we have to exercise jurisdiction over them. Whether our courts can dismiss it would be a matter, for instance, in the Murray court case. In that case, it was determined that at least the plaintiff's choice of form has to be given the same deference if he's a foreign citizen, but they can still exercise their form of convenience discretion over them and dismiss the case if other legitimate state interests, legitimate in that case national interests, allow them
to. We somehow had this discussion yesterday in a case that was argued. And
I realize that today.
The discussion really is we could use that as simply a factor in form non conveniens, but if we use that as the determining factor, then we might violate the treaty.
That's exactly what I'm saying. If, and for example, in our jurisdiction statute, we have other issues. It's not necessarily citizenship we're talking about. First, we're talking about foreign action brought by non-citizens. If it's not a foreign action, we aren't going to discriminate against any foreign citizens. And then also, it's not the fact that they're a foreign citizen, but that their country has not guaranteed them access to our courts. And again, that could change tomorrow. Our federal government could enter into a treaty with India, and it could provide specifically for access, and we wouldn't be here today. On the non-self-execution, very quickly, Your Honor, the two main documents they're relying upon are the International Covenant and the United Nations Charter. Both of these are non-self-executing. The restatement tells us that non-self-executing agreements will not be given effect as law in the absence of necessary congressional implementation.
But they do not affect the United States' international obligations under the treaty. Still binding on the United States to the extent that Congress specifies in what way.
Exactly.
It just means that the actual provisions do not create private rights.
It means the actual provisions don't create private rights, but I think that it pertains to our action, because what this citizen is trying to do is he's trying to say this treaty provides me, a private citizen, equal access to your courts, and you have
to
change
your provide an obligation upon the United States to make sure that that person is treated the same as other people.
Yes, Your Honor. However, our Congress, specifically in the ICCPR, told us that those particular sections, Articles 1 through 27, are non-self-executing. Very few international agreements contain a declaration of that nature. But there's more than just that declaration that we look to determine that it's non-self-executing. The fact that it's an aspirational-type treaty, the same way the United Nations treaty is, they're both aspirational. They're rights that we hope one day in generations to come that all the United States and all the United Nations can all agree on what all their laws will be. But right now, all the domestic laws are different. It's a very complicated matter to assert certain rights throughout the nation. I'll give you an example. This customary international law, I see my time is out, may I finish? The customary international law that Professor Pouch refers to, that has never been determined to be, determined to create or define civil actions. There's a case, Telleran versus Libyan Arab Republic, which is much discussed by the commenters on this section. And this customary international law, it covers things that have been universally accepted by all these nations. And there have been a couple cases where they have found, in fact, there is customary international law that we have to abide by. Those cases are things that involve international crimes like slave trade, piracy, aircraft hijacking. This is things that the case that they cite, Doe versus Islamic Front, Islamic Salvation Front mentioned.
I believe that's fully answered the question. Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the third clause, and the court will take another recess.
All rise.